Hello, I am Pete Real, a high school English and Spanish teacher, an avid reader, and an aspiring writer. Thank you for listening to the Chills at Will podcast, in which we explore the visceral beauty of literature and its connection to our culture, our history, and ourselves. Hello and welcome to episode 78 of the Chills at Will podcast. It is a pleasure to be joined by Matt Ortile. Matt Ortile is the author of the essay collection, The Groom Will Keep His Name, which is a collection about sex, power, and the myths of American society. See, you want to read it already, don't you? BuzzFeed called the book, quote, witty and insightful. Oprah, I think you may have heard of her, said it's one of many queer books that are, quote, changing the literary landscape in 2020. I'd say 2021 as well. Matt is also the managing editor of Catapult Magazine and a contributing writer at Condé Nast Traveler. Previously, he was the founding editor of BuzzFeed Philippines. He's a McDowell Fellow and has written for Vogue, Self, Out, Into, and BuzzFeed News, among others. He's a graduate of Vassar College, which means he now lives in Brooklyn. Welcome, Matt. How are you today?
I'm doing well. How are you doing, Peter?
Pretty good, thanks. And I don't usually have so many corny jokes as I did in that first little bio.
No worries.
But it called for it. In the book, this is a very insignificant question compared to the larger themes we're talking about. But in the book, when you talk about Vassar, your alma mater, you reference The Simpsons. And I remember Lisa referencing Vassar College.
Right.
And I think Homer said, no more of your Vassar bashing. Is that the episode you're talking about? Or am I too much in the minutiae here?
All I really remember is that she has this dream where, like, the seven sister schools personified are talking to her about something. And she's, like, applying to college, I think, is the episode. But, okay. Yeah.
Okay, nicely done. Yes, I remember just the quick one, but you're right. That was more meaningful for sure. Again, thanks so much for joining me. I know you're, we're on the Labor Day holiday, so it's awesome to have you.
Yeah. No worries.
Just finished the book today. Great book, important book, and obviously it's a collection of essays, so there are unifying themes, which we'll talk about, but it does have, I want to say maybe 9 or 10 separate essays.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. 10.
So before there was The Groom Will Keep His Name, there was The Young Matt. Born in the Philippines, born in Manila, am I correct? Or in the metro area?
That's right. I was born in Manila.
Would that be, you talk about obviously all the languages of the Philippines, including Tagalog, which is maybe the best known for non-Filipinos, but what was your relationship to language? I know you spoke English, learned English in schools and all of that. Mm-hmm. What was your relationship just with the written word, I guess, and language in general?
Oh, sure. Well, I think one of the long-running jokes in my family is that I was always better at English than I was in Filipino, in Tagalog specifically. I grew up with both, but I think in my generation and among a certain class set, English was as a kid, you kind of tend to prefer English, if anything, because it just makes you seem cooler, quote unquote. Literally it is more common to speak in Tagalog and Filipino and that's a lot of already, you can flag that as some internalized colonialism already. Mm. even at an age where you're trying to soak up as much language as you can. And, but I was also surrounded by another dialect, another Filipino language actually called, colloquially Ilonggo, more formally, you might call it Hiligaynon, which was spoken by my nannies and my mother. But I can only understand it and hear it, but I don't speak it very well. But it was another one of those kind of things where, oh, okay, here's a language as a tool of communication and connection. And later on, when I got to college and I was kind of on the fence about my whole identity as being, a brown American, a Filipino person in America, and that language, that tertiary language that I picked up from my mother and my nannies was actually something that I used to connect with one of my very close Filipino friends on campus, because that was the only Filipino language that she spoke. And she could only, you know, hear and understand Tagalog, but couldn't really speak it kind of directly or kind of really fluently. So it was one of those interesting things, like, oh, and around really at college age is when I started to really think about language as this thing that is about communication and connection and community. And so now actually I'm traveling, I'm on vacation this week. And so I'm really very aware of how language can, you know, give you a leg up in certain situations versus really hinder or impede your experience of a place, of a people. Sure. But yeah.
Oh, very interesting. What were you reading?
As a kid?
As a kid. I mean, what weren't you reading? I mean, I know it's a big question and a big gap of time, a big space of time.
But... Sure. The nutshell would be that, you know, I think I was reading, my mom gave me like Chicken Soup, you know, the Chicken Soup books. That was something she gave me when we first came to the States. But I think one of my big transition objects, you know, something that was a part of my experience in both the Philippines and in the US, were obviously the Harry Potter books and very much part of that generation. When I moved, I actually distinctly remember the fifth book was the first book that I got in the States, whereas before I would have them shipped over to me by my grandparents. The third and the fourth book came from San Francisco in their big Balik Bayan box, which is like this, you know, literally just a big crate with all kinds of stateside imports that family members in, you know, Filipino Americans would send their family members back home to the Philippines. So I was on the receiving end of it. And my grandparents would send me, you know, I think Nesquik, you know, Ovaltine. And I distinctly remember my fourth Harry Potter book was covered in kind of like a syrupy kind of medicine, you know, like one of those kind of daily multivitamins that you give to a kid so that they can grow taller or something. But yeah, so, you know, I was a Harry Potter kid. Chicken Soup was kind of an introduction to American literature, I guess, for me, because you might consider Harry Potter British literature. But then I had a very early, for whatever reason, I was drawn very early on to nonfiction, particularly David Sedaris, Augustine Burroughs, and reading memoir, particularly queer memoir, kind of helped me see myself in a way on paper that I hadn't before. Even though these were, you know, white men, they were queer. And in my teenage years, I was very much, I'd come out very early on at about 13, and I was trying to find my way through it to navigate, you know, what it means to come into your queerness. And those were some books that really helped me figure it out. And, you know, one thing led to another, and just kind of nonfiction became my kind of preferred writing mode. And so it felt pretty organic that the first book that I've written is essays and memoir, or memoir and essays. Yeah.
Right. Tell me a little bit about this connection with David Sedaris. I mean, I know some of his work. I don't know if it's now just that he's older. I think he's probably in the 70s. He seems to me like an incredibly benevolent, you know, like makes fun of himself, you know, like fun grandpa type. Was that what you read into? Was it simply the fact that he was another queer voice? Was it him in particular? Was all the above? What was it that drew you to him?
The humor, definitely. The kind of self-deprecating, right? I mean, I very recently read something of his in The New Yorker, and he was talking about his late father. So again, he's writing about his family, which he's always done. And you kind of, it's fascinating to see, like, if you're a big kind of Sedaris head, every time he talks about his family, you just know everybody's shorthand, you know, like Amy is Amy Sedaris, you know, it's never like actress and comedian Amy Sedaris. It's just Amy, my sister. Sure. But you kind of, and the characters of his mother, who is his now late mother and now his late father, who I think survived the mother by at least 15 or 20 years. But you kind of see this whole progression of that family. And I think, you know, beside the self-deprecating humor and the kind of nonchalance with which he incorporates his queer identity, his gay identity, his partner, husband, Hugh, he really wrote about navigating the world of his family and the expectations and the challenges and, you know, his own stumbles through life with and without his family. Mm-hmm. I thought that was something, actually now in hindsight, I can see that I really connected with. Before, you know, if you asked me as a teenager, I would say it was because, you know, we were both gay men. But I think I saw even then this real well that he draws from, that is his family. And I think now with kind of recent developments in my family life, something that I'm kind of seeing, oh, it's going to be a big part of my life, obviously, but also definitely my writing life. Yeah.
Oh, thank you for that. Yeah, you talk about Sedaris and getting to know his family and reading over the years. I think I literally just heard one episode of him on with Terry Gross.
Mm.
And it was mainly about his father. And I'm sorry to hear this father passed away. I mean, it's
probably
within the last year or two. But yeah, I definitely felt a connection to him and his father just by listening to, you know, 40 minutes of the radio. So that makes sense.
Yeah.
I think I know the answer, and it's probably two letters based on what I've read in The Groom Will Keep His Name. But I wonder about representation. Did you feel like, you know, everything that makes you up, not just your queer identity, but everything about you, did you feel like you were reading about people like you? Did you feel represented in what you read as a kid?
The first instinct answer is no. You know, the kind of the specificity that you might bring up, say a queer Filipino man, you know, immigrant, I didn't really see that immediately. So no, definitely not in reading. I think there was a little bit more leeway in television and film.
Okay.
The way that you might read many Asian characters as queer or just effeminate, that's how they're written as a stereotype. Or like I would see a lot more gay characters, but they tend to be white, especially growing up in the 90s and early aughts. Hmm. So it was interesting. I kind of have to take bits and pieces of different characters in popular texts and kind of try and synthesize something that looked like me in my own imagination. And there was never kind of an easy, like, obviously, yes, you know, this person. Only kind of in the last 5 years or so could I say, yes, I have seen a queer Filipino character on television. And I think more in literature, I see a lot more queer Filipino writers, you know, working in both fiction and nonfiction. Early on, no, but these days I would say yes, a little bit more. But I've also put a little less weight on kind of representation politics, just because, you know, it has its limits. You know, there's, you know, conversations about that, of course. So to answer your question, no, at first.
The aphorism or the adage is something to the effect of read about, if you want to know about one man, read nonfiction. If you want to know about all men, read fiction. Right. So I wonder if there was fiction there is currently fiction that where you feel represented. And again, you said, you know, representation is not everything. I don't know if I'm quoting you right there, but I guess just the idea of what fiction have you read maybe that you've really felt, whether it represented you or not, that has really given you chills at will, to kind of, to quote the name of the podcast, that, you know, they're really thrilling, really, man, this is so good.
I hear you though. I think these days the kind of the thrill that I get of recognition, let's say, it's less about seeing myself in something else. Seeing like, oh, that is my exact same experience, or oh my god, that's a mirror image of me. I kind of don't see that as much, and I'm not terribly widely read. I tend to have because I read for a living, you know, working at a magazine where I read other people's work constantly. People are always asking me, what are you reading for fun? It's like, I don't I read for work, so I don't want to, when I try to relax or have fun, I try to not look at words. But the thing of recognition, I think, is something that I would say I feel is, I wouldn't say more important, but I respond to a little bit more. Mm-hmm. So all of that to say, I would say in fiction, one particular book that comes to mind is this book by a Filipina author named Mia Alvar. Okay. Mia, M-I-A, Alvar, A-L-V-A-R, a Filipina immigrant based in America. And she's a little bit of a third culture kid as well, having grown up born in the Philippines, I believe, and raised in Bahrain in the Middle East. And then grew up as well in the US, I believe in New York, and definitely attended school in New York. And so her book, it's a collection of short stories called In the Country. And so these short stories draw from a very wide kind of Filipino diaspora, you know, Filipinos in the Philippines, Filipinos in the Middle East, Filipinos in the US, Filipinos throughout time. And it was really cool to see people who looked like my community, certainly. And I could see some kind of traits in the characters that I possessed, or traits in characters or descriptions of characters that seemed to fit with my aunts and uncles or my grandparents. And that, I think, was pretty powerful for me, because Mia was writing about a collective, a diaspora, a community that, and a community with its own strengths and weaknesses, its own faults and successes, that felt very true to the communities and spaces, Filipino spaces that I've experienced. And I think that's, there's something really cool in that, because I think one of the failings of representation politics is that very often we expect one particular character in, say, a film to represent multiple kinds of, you know, people who resemble that character. Thinking right now about, you know, it's like September 2021, Shang-Chi and the Ten Rings just came out. Legend of the Ten Rings just came out. I'm not actually even sure what the right title is, but Shang-Chi came out. And, you know, there's kind of like this cool, oh, it's the first like Asian-led, Asian majority cast in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And, you know, but it's still, I'm hearing some people who really, really love it. Some people who are like, meh, you know, it's like, you know, if you want a real Asian film, watch House of Flying Daggers, which is like, that's a completely different thing. And so a lot of people have different kinds of expectations for one kind of character or one kind of piece of art. And it's inevitably going to disappoint some people, make some people really proud. And so that's, I feel like, can be the risk that you take when, you know, and every kind of piece of art takes risks, but that is the kind of thing that you run the risk of when you are trying to represent one character or a small set of characters. What I think that this book by Mia Alvar is great at, and even though, you know, not every kind of Filipino is represented in its pages, it doesn't try to present only one kind of positive image of a Filipino person or of a Filipino family or of the Philippine country. If anything, I remember profiling her actually for BuzzFeed Philippines ages ago. And one of the things that she said was, I wanted to present, and I'm paraphrasing her, one of the things I wanted to do was to just show Filipinos behaving their worst. Because one of the things that Filipinos are kind of have hangups over is always being represented positively, always presenting that kind of famed Filipino hospitality or that kind of positive attitude or the stereotype of being hardworking. You know, one of our biggest exports in the Philippines from the Philippines is humans, nurses, you know, seafarers, people working on cruise ships, and all of that to say, you know, it was cool to see a book that didn't try to be one thing, to be one good thing. It wanted to just present humans in with multiple dimensions and facets. So I thought that was very cool.
Wow. Thank you for sharing that. A good name to
look
up, a good name to look up and to read. One more question to kind of about language, and then we'll get more into the specifics of your writing. I wonder if, you know, Tagalog as a language, if there are parts of its structure, the way it's spoken, the way it's written, that have kind of have informed your English, have informed your writing overall. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I do. That's a great question, because so the thing about it is that, again, it wasn't my best subject at school. So the way that that I am now able, especially as an editor, you know, able to sort of identify, okay, subject versus object, you know, like dependent clause versus independent clause, you know, like those kinds of parts of language. I'm kind of able to see the mechanics in English a little bit better now.
Okay.
I hope so. I hope my writers think so. But speaking Tagalog is, for me, kind of innate. It's more instinctual. Mm-hmm. And so I'm not quite as able to see the parts that make up the whole.
Sure.
So in the thinking about a question where am I able to inform my writing in English by how I speak in Tagalog, I would want my answer to be, yes, I do. But that's more of an aspirational thing because as it stands, I don't. Mm-hmm. But it's really cool. And because I'm thinking about it like right now, this would be a whole other kind of session, but mm-hmm. you know, I don't necessarily know how to kind of take my influences and how I speak Tagalog versus how I might write in English. So no, unfortunately, but it would be a cool exercise to try and figure some kind of connections out or try some kind of exercise about this is how you might construct a sentence in Tagalog, right. or this is how you might try to express the same emotion. Right. I guess so, kind of evolving the question too, it's like, you know, it's interesting because the book is so America focused, mm-hmm. it doesn't feel as if, like, I remember my team was trying to explore translation opportunities into Tagalog, and it doesn't mm-hmm. quite happen. I mean, broadly across books, because the English literacy rate in the Philippines is pretty high, and a lot of people do read books in English. There wouldn't really have been a need. I would have loved those translation fees, but you know, it wasn't, it's not really in the cards. So, but it would be a cool exercise to try and translate like maybe one essay into Tagalog. Mm-hmm. I think I would have a different sense of humor, I think, in Tagalog. And I think a lot of the jokes would be lost just because so much of it is like play on like English, on American culture and the English language. And yeah. So the short answer to the question is no. No, my Tagalog does not influence my English all that much.
But I appreciate that, though, especially the last part. Yeah. Was it kind of like a tongue-in-cheek humor? Is that how you describe it? Or in Tagalog, you talked about kind of like poking fun almost at American ways?
English. Not quite. I mean, just literally what I mean is that in Tagalog, I have my jokes would be different because
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I think Filipino Filipino humor, and a particular kind of Filipino humor, is also very different. Mm-hmm. There's kind of different comedic rules, or you know, whatever you might call it.
Okay, mm-hmm. You are a young and successful writer, and I'll stress young, right?
Thank you.
And so, you know, where were those eureka moments, or was there one eureka moment, or you know, on the way to like saying like, hey, I can do this. I can get paid for writing. People are going to want to read what I write. Where do those come up?
I would say, I think maybe one essay that I published at BuzzFeed in 2014. It was about Roland Barthes and his book, A Lover's Discourse. And it was about a breakup that I had at the time. And so I was trying to combine this kind of very academic, I had just graduated Vassar. So I was still very like, trying to aspire to some kind of literary sensibility that I haven't given up. and is it kind of combining that very intellectual kind of reading of a relationship, which is one might say is a little bit more emotional, mm-hmm. base, you know, kind of common, but also romantic. And you know, people have written about breakups before, and I tried to do something a little bit different by tying it to this particular academic's text. And mm-hmm. it seemed to really hit. I remember my editors were relatively surprised at how popular it was when it was published. And I think that was one of those kind of moments where it clicked, where it was like, oh, I can talk about relationships in a smart way. Mm-hmm. And so that was one of my, if not necessarily the North Star, it was one of the sort of constellations that I tried to keep in my sky while I was navigating the ocean of trying to publish a book. And that was one of the things where I was like, no, this works. People like stuff like this. People inherently understand that the ways that we interpret relationships, the ways that we interpret sex, the ways that we interpret sexuality, there's something there that, you know, people pull from and can extrapolate into like bigger things in their lives or other things in their lives, mm-hmm. and can make meaning out of that. And so for me, the more that I dug deep into writing about relationships, I realized, oh, I'm actually also writing about race and immigration and desire and power. And so kind of leaning on those foundations really helped me, you know, stay strong while I was writing the book. Whenever, you know, you had those moments where you're like, I can't do this, you know, who am I kidding? Those kinds of moments. And I just had to think about some of those kinds of, you know, as you say, eureka moments and kind of keep the faith.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I don't know this for sure. My educated guess is that, you know, like a BuzzFeed would have very advanced metrics, for example, like, you know, about who's reading that. I mean, did you get, was that somewhere it's skewed very young? Like, I don't know, the 18 to
34
or hard
to tell. Age wise, I don't remember if we had that data at the time, because I don't remember it, period. But, I mean, what I could see were essentially comments, right? So comments on the post, shares on Twitter or shares on Facebook. And it was cool to see a lot of people both in America and in the Philippines reading it.
Mm-hmm.
Even though the essay itself didn't talk about being Filipino, but knowing that I had was starting to develop a small kind of following on Twitter that also had Filipinos on it, it was cool to see them really engage with it too. Also, it was really cool to see people. I distinctly remember one comment that went along the lines of, you know, this person, she was saying that she's a Latina older woman. I think she mentioned she was a mother or something. But like the point was that she was someone who was very different from me is what she was saying. And she said, but I was still able to connect with your writing. And it was really cool. Another one of those reminders that, you know, you don't have to share everything with a writer or a character to be able to connect with them, as long as, you know, you find some kind of truth or power or in the thing that you're reading or watching, and it can speak to you that way, even though the person that you're reading or watching on screen is no one like you. Mm-hmm. So that was really cool to see.
Yeah. What a beautiful compliment, right?
Yeah. It was really nice.
Oh man. The Groom Will Keep His Name is over my shoulder here. And I mean, it's obviously nonfiction. It's about you. You know, you talk about real people in your life. And I think it's on your website where it said something like, some of your boyfriends were saying, you know, like, hey, don't write about me to that effect, which I know is kind of like half joking because you do, but I think with some different names. But I mean, you know, you talk about family and you know, nothing to rip on people. I mean, honest about yourself. What was it like to really just put yourself out there? Like, ooh, this is my life. This is not just my life, my mom and my family.
Yeah. So in terms of my life and kind of bearing it all quite literally in the book, for better or for worse, I'm a little bit shameless, and I don't particularly, you know, I'm not embarrassed to talk about, you know, in the book, I talk about cruising in a gym steam room or like literally all of these white boys that I've dated and, you know, kind of really dragging myself about like this kind of white desire that I've had to contend with all my life and, you know, all the good stuff and the bad stuff that I've experienced at a certain point. Mm-hmm. And though I do keep some things for myself, I knew that, you know, to write the kind of book that I wanted to write, I wanted to share as much of myself as I can in a way that would, you know, I wanted it to be an enjoyable read. I wanted it to have the candor and the humor, but also I knew, though I don't think I would have been able to articulate it in this way before maybe the book was published, or maybe even while I was writing it, I knew that I wanted to share as much as I could that felt safe, at least. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that's one thing a lot of nonfiction and memoir writers kind of contend with is, you know, how do I share as much of myself as possible without kind of diving into trauma porn or kind of, you know, giving so much of myself up. But I wanted to do a good amount because I felt when I read writers who did that kind of work in my reading experience, I trusted them more. And I it made me connect with them on a in a way that helped me really hear their arguments or really hear their stories and kind of try to, it helps me believe someone, frankly. Mm-hmm. I think one of the things, and to sort of turn it into a craft thing, when I work with my writers and when they write their personal essays at Catapult, sometimes you can feel when they're still holding a writer at arm's length, holding a reader at arm's length, when their writer is still kind of at a distance because either they're tiptoeing around something or they're beating around the bush, or, you know, they might not even be ready to write about the thing that they're trying to write about. And kind of half the work that I do as an editor is like helping people figure out what they are, you know, safely able to write about. And so, but all of that to say, for me, I wanted to be able to do that because I didn't want anyone to feel like I was trying to, you know, keep anyone at an arm's length, at arm's length, when I'm writing about such intimate things as race and bodily experiences and sex and relationships and intimacy. Yeah, I think that I'm, for better or for worse, I am kind of shameless in that way. But then thinking about my, you know, the men that appear in the book, I wanted to make sure that identifying details were as scrubbed as possible, though I have had a few people to various degrees and various reactions say, oh, so I read your book, and redacted. With regards to my family, so my mother is a very big character in the book. And now, she was such a big, and the book is dedicated to her. And she was, my mother passed away last summer. And, you know, the time that we shared together was incredibly influential in my life. And she really shaped so much of who I am now and the kind of resources and privileges and kind of life literally that I have is because of her, because of our immigration story. So I wanted to flesh that relationship out as much as I could, but also do it in a way that where she felt comfortable, because I think she had some concerns certainly about how other people in her life might read the book if they ever decided to. And so one thing that I did do before publication was, once the book was close to done, I shared not the whole book with her, but I shared every page where she and my stepfather were mentioned. And so it was, I said, here are the pages where you are, please, you know, fact check anything if you need. But more importantly, if there is anything in these pages that I'm sharing with you that you feel uncomfortable with, let's talk about it. I didn't give her veto power, but I wanted there to be no surprises. And I wanted there to be an opportunity for us to discuss getting at the truth of our relationship in a way that didn't jeopardize or make anyone in our lives extremely vulnerable. Mm-hmm. And I'm very grateful that while she was alive, she was able to do that. And the kind of dramatic irony of it all is that she passed away, you know, a few days after the book was published. And by the time it did come out, she was in a state in her health where she couldn't read. And so I am grateful, certainly now after the fact, that this book really, you know, it holds a version of my mother that I felt, and I would like to say that she felt, was true and representative of at least our relationship as mother and son. So that's kind of the, you know, kind of the big challenges, one of the big challenges and one of the big beauties of writing memoir.
You know, your mother comes through with such a beautiful spirit in the book.
Thank you.
And I hadn't known that she passed away, and I'm so sorry to hear that.
Thank you very much for your condolences.
Yeah. I mean, just the gap in time between the publishing and just now, it's so sad to hear that. I know that she'd had her health scares for sure. And oh boy.
Yeah.
I'm so sorry to hear that.
Thank you.
She does come across as a beautiful spirit for sure.
Thanks.
I wonder, I guess kind of a two-part question then, like these two-parters, right? you know, the idea of like writing about things, I was going to ask you this before I found out the horrible news about your mother, even like, you know, the idea of like, oh, writing about it is cathartic, writing about it, you know, it cleanses, it helps, you know, it helps me to feel better about things and to identify them and such. So, you know, is that true? Is that too cliche? Is that too corny? And then secondly, is even that changed by the fact that I'm sure you reread the book so many times, you know, it's almost like a, you know, somebody working at McDonald's and they're tired of burgers. You know what I mean? Like maybe that's a terrible analogy. Your writing is much better than a McDonald's hamburger, but just this idea that, you know, you've gone through so many revisions and such. I wonder if some of the possible, you know, emotional, you know, hitting you emotionally could have maybe been lessened by the fact that you read it so many times.
Oh, well, so first of all, I will say I do love a McDonald's burger every now and then. So, right?
Oh, so good.
Okay. I'm more of like a McChicken kind of guy, but I do love a burger sometimes. So I'll get at the second question first about, does it kind of, does the, maybe the kind of impact of the thing for me personally dull over time. It did for a little bit. I think I was sick of it at some point. I could not read it anymore. I think after my virtual book tour, because it was literally, you know, summer of 2020, it was a pretty rough time for a lot of people. Didn't want to look at it anymore. I didn't want to do any readings, but every now and then, you know, I would see like later in 2020 or anytime this year, if someone say takes a photo of a page and puts it on their Instagram story and tags me in it, sometimes I'll read it. I'm like, oh, wow, damn, that was good. Like, he's a writer. And sometimes I do feel like, oh, I would have done this a little bit differently. But so I think if anything, it's helped me sometimes forget, like, oh, I wrote that. Or like, I think the kind of idea that like, oh, a different person wrote that, right? I was writing that predominantly in 2019 and writing about a particular version of Matt Artile, it was also kind of in having to write the memoir, I had to sort of contend with, okay, there has to be an ending point for this Matt Artile, ending for now, right? Yeah. Not necessarily happily ever after, but like there had to be an arc for this character and he had to land somewhere. Mm-hmm. But then literally, you know, 2019, I finish it, I guess right top of 2020, because we were still editing in like January a little bit, like, you know, proof pages. I've experienced so many new things since then, the biggest of them being that my mother died. And so my connection to my family has changed. I haven't been home to the Philippines because of the pandemic. And so my connection to the Philippines has changed a lot. Like I was reading the chapter actually on the plane right over here. I'm listening to my audio book. I couldn't fall asleep on the plane. I was like, maybe I will bore myself.
So many levels right there. Wow.
Yeah.
That's so meta. Wow.
Yeah. And I was listening to myself talk about traveling to the Philippines and, you know, being really excited to be able to visit home more often. And literally I'm like, I'm here in Vienna for the week. I went to Europe instead.
Okay.
Because there would be no quarantine requirement versus like if I had gone home to the Philippines, it would have been me to quarantine for 14 days. And like I can't do any of these things that I'm talking about anymore. So literally the book feels like a different person a little bit. And the end of it kind of tries to set up a next chapter in Matt Artile's life, literally another book in Matt Artile's life. Yeah. But that book feels really different from what I think now I'm experiencing. So the next memoir is going to feel really different from what I first expected. And please, sorry, Peter, remind me about the first half of the question.
Yeah, I forget it too. No, I'm just kidding. It was just the idea of like writing such a personal story and any sort of catharsis, you know, that came through that.
Catharsis, I wouldn't say catharsis actually for me. I mean, now having mentioned everything about the second part of the question about looking at a very different kind of version of me in the past, I'm happy certainly that I was able to preserve a kind of version of me, or definitely preserve my mother in a kind of way, in a kind of vision of her. I mean, that the mother in the book is not necessarily my mother in life exactly. This is certainly how I saw her, but how my stepfather saw her for a fact is different. He didn't see her as a mother. Well, he saw her as like my mother, but he saw her first and foremost as his wife, right?
Sure.
So the way that people might read her in this book could be very different from how people understand her in life. But I'm also very grateful that like folks who never knew her in life get to experience her in this way and now get to hold her in their memories too, which is kind of cool. But it never felt like writing the book wasn't like a huge release. It certainly felt like a big dream achieved. Though it was foiled by the pandemic in a certain way, I am glad at least that it happened. So now it's actually kind of shifted my kind of my how I work with my nonfiction, I think. I think these days I'm more interested in, and this is possibly how other nonfiction writers work already. Certainly for me, I think, you know, it was about processing and making meaning out of the things that I experience in life, right? And connecting the dots, so to speak. Yeah. And that's still very much that. But now I think I'm so much more aware of how this is still a process of archival, of memory keeping, of just like saving experiences in a way. Even though I do talk about that kind of work in the book, literally about memory, I think now more than ever, to use the phrase, because of just the loss that I've experienced with my mom's death, I'm just kind of more keenly aware of how every kind of story that I try to tell about myself, I'm not just doing it for others. I think I'm now really doing it for myself. Just like, remember this part, remember this part.
On a lighter note, I think your I think your epigraph is perfect.
Thank you very much. I have to thank Ari for it.
Right?
Yeah.
Just, I guess just to wrap up, you know, the bookends of the essay, the first one is Barong. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Yeah.
Barong Tagalog. And the last is the title story, right?
Yes.
And, you know, just the idea of, you know, identity is obviously such a huge part of the book. You reference yourself as a queer, immigrant, brown, Filipino. I wonder about the term queer. You know, I know there's you know, the history of queer and gay and, you know, is that the idea of like reclaiming that term that's been used so negatively for so many years? I wonder kind of why you personally, you know, find meaning in that.
Totally. So from my understanding and just from the kind of communities that I run in, queer is used definitely as a reclamation of something that used to be, you know, something pejorative or, slur, essentially. And it feels like more of an umbrella term that allows more flexibility for the kind of spectrum of anything that's not heterosexual, essentially. You know, beyond just LGBT, you know, lesbian, gay, bi, and transgender, you know, there's a lot of folks who use the word queer to describe themselves because they are asexual or demisexual or asexual but heteroromantic or, you know, or homoromantic but heterosexual. There's this whole that I'm also learning about, but literally anything that kind of bucks the societal norm,
sure.
Or goes against that grain, and queer makes space for a lot of these things that are labeled and not things that are, more common and not, and so it's also kind of one of those, it also has its failings, but from how I see it, it offers someone a name, a label, something to hold on to while they're also still trying to figure out their own identities. Because you might be, you know, one thing one year, and as you continue to do this kind of personal work, all that good stuff, and you discover that you might actually be more of this or more of that. And so I think it, for me, I want to use it as something that was inclusive. I do kind of in a boring way, identify as just a cis gay man. And we have our own issues too and our own privileges and harms and failings. So, I mean, that might be something to talk about more another time.
Obviously the idea, I mean, it's one thing to say like, oh, you know, decolonize your bookshelf and decolonize this. You put very personal specifics on it. Just the idea of, like you talk about, like some of your romantic longings for the white man, and just, you know, so much about the, you know, that first story that I talk about is the Americana is basically
like
the suit maybe that we think of with the shirt and tie, right? Versus the Filipino style clothing, especially pre-colonization, right? Colorful, And I was especially struck by the idea of, like, you know, no shirt underneath, no pockets. You said that maybe the story was, you know, perhaps not historic, you know, it's not known, maybe mythical, but this idea that, you know, even pockets weren't allowed because of, you know, they're going to take something. And, you know, mestizo and moreno and all of the, one thing that really stood out to me as well was the idea of, yes, there have been Filipino politicians who would be considered to be moreno, I guess, including Duterte. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But just like in America, right? Celebrities kind of run everything.
Yep. Yeah.
And that celebrity culture has it that, you know, you talk about, you know, bicultural or biracial Filipinos and very, very light-skinned Filipinos, mestizos, who are pretty much the ones who win the Miss, you know, Philippines and all of that.
So, yeah.
You know, so the colonization, I mean, you just have a straight history lesson throughout the book that's great. And then to, you know, connect it to yourself is pretty incredible. You know, and then just the idea of, you talk about that, to quote you, the Romans, because you use the Latin term, the Romans weaponized oblivion.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, yeah, you coming from the Philippines, I can say the same. Like, how much did we learn in school about the Bataan Death March?
Yeah.
I remember I was in the library at Long Beach State University maybe 4 or 5 years ago, and I never heard this in my life. I was reading about basically like waterboarding, you know, that was done like in recent years, like started in the Philippines in the Filipino-American War.
Yeah.
You know, and just, so I just wonder if that's a lot there to give you, but if you can maybe talk about the idea of like just oblivion, not that necessarily the Filipinos have been seen as negative nor positive, and they have, but just like the oblivion, like you talk about, just not talked about.
Yeah.
You know, just kind of how that has hit you over the years.
Totally. Erasure, I think, is something that a lot of people, it's one of those kinds of part of the kind of movement to decolonize ourselves, whether, you know, as non, you know, non-white people learning to reclaim their own heritages, their cultures, and understanding how much white supremacy has impacted their lives and their own tastes and values. I think that kind of erasure, oblivion, is why there is such a, that's why there's a lot of people who want representation,
right,
and who want themselves seen in, on screens, on platforms that are big, because that means then that they are not only seen by themselves, but others see someone like them too. Mm-hmm. And so that's all powerful stuff. And it also has its own kinds of, it's very much that double-edged sword, as I mentioned earlier. But that kind of erasure, I think, and was why I wanted to flesh out as much as I could of these more researched historical parts of the book, not only as a reminder to myself, but to a lot of folks who are like me, Filipino. And I think one of the things that is so kind of diabolical about how American empire works, present tense, is how it encourages the people who are subjugated by American empire to turn away from their own roots, to turn away from their own cultural inheritances. Mm-hmm. And I'll say that what I've seen in a lot of, you know, first generation, second generation, you know, even third and fourth generation Filipinos, now people who are my contemporaries and younger than me, they're really trying to engage with their own, with their, you know, with their culture and with the Filipino language, to bring it back to the top of the conversation. Mm-hmm. I think there, you know, there's Tagalog classes coming up more and more. But the kind of thing that's still a bummer for me as someone who is an immigrant, someone who grew up in the Philippines and moved to the States, even though I was, you know, a preteen, I still kind of for a long time have felt this half and half. I was not born on American soil. And so I really have felt like an immigrant. I mean, now it's kind of shifting a little bit more. I've definitely spent more of my life in the States outside of the Philippines than I have in it. But all of that to say, I still get very sad when I try to talk to someone who is Filipino or Filipino American and they don't know, you know, a lick of Tagalog, because they didn't care to learn it when they were kids and refused it when their parents tried to teach them when they were younger, or possibly even have no interest now. Or if they've always wanted to learn it, but they just didn't have the resources because their parents refused to teach them, right, because they felt that if they learned the language and spoke with an accent, spoke English with an accent, then the kids would have a harder time at school or would have a harder time in society. And so they really, you know, all of that internalized colonization not only comes from society, but also directly from, you know, families too sometimes. Mm-hmm. And so again, that sense of oblivion is so painful, I think, very viscerally for a lot of folks. And I am very privileged in a way to have to be an immigrant, to have this mm-hmm. kind of closer connection to my homeland.
Right.
And that I still consider it my homeland. It's mm-hmm. very much a part of who I am. And mm-hmm. I definitely consider myself an American, but I also have being Filipino as part of myself. And sometimes it's a bummer when, you know, some people, for better or for worse, don't claim Filipino-ness as their own, which, you know, that's their life, their choices. But I always have to wonder, like, you know, if we lived in a different society, if we lived in a better world, would you be saying that? And mm-hmm. it's one of those hard thought exercises because we can't imagine that. This is the world that we live in. So we have to work under these systems and try to dismantle the ones that actively hurt us and oppress us, the ones that actively make us forget, the ones that actively throw us into oblivion.
Right. Yeah. One of the scenes that I'll definitely remember is, well, a couple of those scenes where you're going for the, you're basically like reclaiming, like literally reclaiming your citizenship in the Philippines.
Yeah.
After having to give it up for, you know, and just, that's obviously so metaphoric, you know, so it's like,
it's very convenient, right? It's for like, me as a writer. Yeah.
And, then of course, you know, talking about oblivion and lack of knowledge, I think in eighth grade and your teacher was so surprised at how well you spoke English.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And right. And there's poor 13 or 14 year old you having to like, do I educate this woman? Do I tell her the whole history of colonization in the U.S.? Or I just say, yeah. Just say, thank you. Thank you. Next.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
To end with, you talk about the Tagalog idea of kapwa. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Yeah.
You know, which, you know, could be seen in the negative, this idea of like, I think a lot of people know that the crab metaphor, as they kind of come out of the bucket, kind of pulling each other down.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things that does come through in the book that's beautiful is the communities that you have and the families that you have established.
Mm-hmm.
Right. The text chains you have with friends, you know, some in the same community, some are not. And just safety, the different families. You talk, of course, about your mom being such a great person. And your stepfather seems like a great man. You know, you talk about how great their marriage was and all the communities. You know, you come out to some of the weddings on the West Coast. And while there's that idea of, you know, the crabs, there's also the idea of like togetherness and all these different communities, which is one of the 9,000 great things about this book.
Thank you very much.
And I'm gonna promote it like heck. And in my little corner of the world, I'm gonna put it in my classroom library as I'm a high school teacher.
And, thank you, Peter. I really appreciate that.
You're very welcome. And I know it's just a matter of which. I know that I'll be using one of these essays, if not more, in some teaching. So I just got to figure out which one.
Oh, thank you. One of the more PG ones, PG-13.
yeah, okay, right. And obviously what you just talked about with oblivion and such is reason number 2,843. I just made that number up, that, you know, something like CRT needs to be taught, you know, critical race theory. And I mean, just how could it not? How could we not go back and talk about all these things about colonization and such? It's so really appreciated reading your book. I know you're on vacation. I
thank
really
you.
Appreciate your time.
Thank you, Peter. I appreciate the opportunity to be here.
Hope this was just another event on your itinerary, right? That made your vacation great.
Oh, yeah. I actually do have a writing class tomorrow at around the same time. So I'm like up late. Like I have to check. It's like 2:30 now. So I'm like, yeah.
Well, get some sleep. Get some sleep.
Thank you.
It was a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Peter. Take care.
Take care. Thank you for listening to episode 79 with Matt Ortile. You can now subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts and leave me a 5-star review. You can also ask for the Chills the Will podcast by name using Alexa and find it on Stitcher, Spotify, and on Amazon Music. Follow me on Instagram, where I'm at Chills at Will Podcast, or on Twitter, where I'm at Chills at Will PO1. You can watch this and other episodes on YouTube. Watch and subscribe to the Chills at Will Podcast channel. This is a passion project of mine, a DIY operation, and I'd love for your help in promoting what I'm convinced is a unique and spirited look in an often ignored art form. The intro song for the Chills at Will Podcast is Wind Down, instrumental version. And the other song played on the episode is Hoops, instrumental by Matt Whitehour. Both songs are used through archesaudio.com. I'm excited to share my next episode with Dave Zirin, the nation's sports editor and the author of 10 books on the politics of sports. Most recently, as of September 14th, The Kaepernick Effect, Taking a Knee, Changing the World. He also hosts the nation's Edge of Sports podcast. Our episode will be published on September 21st. I hope you can tune in. For now, thanks again for listening. I hope that these quarantine days bring you texts by writers with mad skills, like Matt Ortile, whose work, including The Groom Will Keep His Name, gives you chills at will. Thank you.